Start recording. So I like to start off every interview to just frame myself and say my name, Nathaniel Janik. I'm the Career Services Coordinator here at AGU. I am with Felicita White, who works on Centennial, and Catherine, I don't know how to pronounce your last name.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm Catherine McCammon,
mm-hmm.
and I'm an AGU member.
Yes.
And I've been a volunteer with AGU for many years now.
Yeah. And so I know you're here. It's just so that I make sure that we actually have the date in here. It's July 27th. No, it's July 26th, right?
Yeah.
July 26th, 2018. Catherine's here because the governance committee is meeting. And so we're taking this opportunity to interview her for the AGU Narratives Project. Depending on, I don't know, the shape of the interview, I also have a project called Path Through Science, where I sort of highlight the paths that our members took to get where they're at. And I share it through my career services, blog and other newsletter stuff to just sort of expose students and early career scientists to sort of where their path might lead. So the question I like to start off with is, asking you to tell a little bit about yourself and what you do as a scientist.
Okay. So a bit about myself.
Yeah.
I'm a Canadian.
Okay.
But I have lived in Germany for almost 30 years. So this is quite a long time. In terms of science, I think I fit most closely into mineral physics at AGU, but I've been involved with volcanology, geochemistry, and petrology also. I think the solid earth sections at AGU are all very closely entwined, and so I think it's not unusual that people in the solid earth find resonance with more than one section. So specifically, I have a technique of looking at iron oxidation states, and it sounds rather arcane, and so who cares whether it's iron 2 plus or iron 3 plus, but what I've done, I think, in my entire career is to look and see where does that make a difference, where does that make a contribution that is really unique that you couldn't get from anything else. And so it covers things like from early atmospheres to magma generation and diamond stability and preservation and so on. And so I've been able to find a nice niche for myself.
So it sounds like, and from my experience of talking with other people, if you have sort of a niche field, you probably have a lot of experience collaborating with other disciplines.
Yes, collaboration is something that I really zeroed in on in terms of telling a story today.
Yeah.
And so that's really the message that I want to talk about today is collaboration and teamwork. And the part of the story that I wanted to start with is because I was an assistant professor in Vancouver in the late 80s. And there in the geology department, it's a very diverse department because they have to cover many different fields. You're basically preparing the undergraduates to go out and be able to map in the field and do petroleum geology and paleontology and so on. So that means people in the department are relatively isolated in terms of their own research fields. And I was isolated. I was really happy because I was doing my own work and living in a super place in Vancouver. But then this opportunity came up to go to Germany, to this institute where we, at that time in 1990, there were about 50 people, let's say, who were all focused on similar things. And so I continued doing my own work, but it was such a creative environment that, you know, I was starting to get single author papers in Nature and Science. But I also discovered along the way that it was fun to collaborate, that you're part of a group and each person in the group is contributing something that's really unique for them that, you know, I mean, it's an old cliche, but it's so true. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. And so I began to collaborate in really meaningful ways that really raised my profile. I mean, I would say back in Vancouver, I mean, maybe I was known to a handful of people in the very close fields that I was working on. But once I started in Germany and started collaborating with all these different people, and really it was a fountain of papers that were coming out, that I became a lot better known in the community, which led to being nominated to be a section president for AGU. And that really opened an entirely new door for me, and that was leadership. Because I never considered myself to be a leader. I'm not one of those natural leaders that takes charge and boldly goes into the future. I mean, that was my idea of what a leader should be. And maybe I can share something that I read in one of my favorite books by Canadian astronaut, Chris Hadfield. And he has a definition of leadership that, and I'll paraphrase here, okay. that leadership isn't about glorious crowning acts. It's about creating an environment and guiding your team to do great things, and then just standing back and letting them shine. And that, I think, encompasses what I've learned about leadership from AGU, and we come back to collaboration and teamwork, because everything that I've been involved with AGU, so all of the task forces, all of the committees, have involved this unique contributions from the different members that brings a whole that's so much greater than the sum of its parts. And people ask me, well, why do you keep saying yes when they ask you to be on all these task forces and committees? Yeah. And, my response is, well, it's fun, because being in a position, I mean, I've known, I would say, for a very long time that I realized I was the sort of person who likes to make a difference in whatever way is meaningful for me. And I realize that through collaboration and teamwork, I found this way to make a difference. And that for me has been a really valuable thing, that if somebody had told me that, say 30, 40 years ago at the start of my career, I'm not sure I really would have, I thought, okay, yeah, that sounds good. And you have to live through it in order to really get it. But
Something when I was looking at your background that intrigued me, how important was it for you to, do international studies? Because, I mean, you say you're Canadian, and then you did your undergraduate, I think, at MIT, and then you moved out of the U.S. and, I think, over to Australia? And then you went back to Canada, and then you bounced over to Germany. What was the impact there of getting all of the exposure to these different cultures?
So I guess it started as I was growing up, because both my parents are geologists. And so as a child of a geologist, there were, of course, all the field trips. There were the sabbaticals. So I guess when I was in high school, was when the traveling really started. So I did 2 years of high school in the United States, and then my father went on sabbatical to Canada. So I did the next year in Canada, and then he went to New Zealand to finish his sabbatical. And so I went to New Zealand and finished my high school time there. And I guess along the way, I realized what an expanded view. Well, I was embarrassed, actually, because I realized that the history that we had been taught in the United States was a very narrow view of the world. And I really appreciated the expanded possibilities. And so I think when I did my undergraduate work at MIT, I decided that I really wanted to continue in an area that I would that I would expand myself. I found the life of the nerd was not really for me. So that's why I went to Australia. And then I married an Australian who's also quite adventurous. He's a mountain guide for a living. And so,
So does he now continue. Do mountain guide work in Germany?
Actually, so ironically, because he's Australian and has Canadian landed immigrant status, he is not permitted to work within the European Union. Uh-huh. I think this is not unusual for labor laws. So he spends every summer, he goes to the Canadian Rockies to guide there. Yeah. And as we speak, he's probably guiding people up in cool. the high mountains.
Yeah. But do you feel like your work, what you do, has influenced probably how he is as a guide? You know, I feel like people around me now are like, will identify like birds or things because they've.
Yes, is he better able to describe the geology of his?
Oh, I see. Okay,
yeah, I think she's getting it.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that, and certainly for a lot of people that might be an affirmative answer. But you know, in our case, I think when we first decided that we were going to get married, we both decided that independence was really important to us, and so. We don't actually cross paths at all. Yeah. So, of course, we take great interest in each other's activities, but I would say the influence isn't really there.
That's been kind of an overall story. As we've been talking to different people, and it's interesting to learn how you also mold your personal life and what that means and what choices you made. So just even sharing that little bit helps people to understand what the life of a scientist is or what drove you to get there or brought people together. Yeah. So interesting to kind of hear those different perspectives.
That's interesting because it was mountain climbing that brought us together.
I think that there's a lot.
It was not science.
Well, I mean, I think that there is something there as far as, you know, like a lot of AGU members are very big into the out of doors and, you know, like to go hiking and have that sort of expeditionary sort of outlook on life.
Okay.
So yeah. So the idea that you mentioned that you're adventurous and expansive in the way that you think, how has that influenced your role as a leader in AGU?
Okay, I think. Not being afraid to take risks. I mean, I see AGU as a very forward-thinking organization, and I mean the task forces that I've been on have very much embodied this principle. You try something out, you learn, and then you regroup and then go into the future. You don't get into the future with a progressive vision unless you take risks. And I think the AGU building is one really nice example of that, because I understand there's a lot of, well, putting everything together. This is the first, really, when they flip the switch and, okay.
Yeah, it will be the definitely the first of its kind in DC. And I mean, something that I really like about AGU is the fact that I can be part of an organization that isn't just pushing its objectives, but it's also trying to find ways to live its objectives and live its goals. Like the Ethics Center, for example, that Billy Williams is working on, that's something that really impresses me, and just the progressive nature of trying to push science to a place where it's not just diversity, it's not just inclusion, but it's also equity. You know, the building, for example, we're not just studying the problems that exist in Earth's environment. We're also finding solutions and actually implementing them. So yeah, it is a nice organization to be a part of, I think.
It's an exciting organization. Yeah. I'm often asked, so I'm based in Germany, and so they ask, well, why are you going to Washington again? Why don't you do something on this side of the ocean? And my response is, well, I actually do. And what I've learned from AGU has enabled me to be a lot more progressive with implementing ideas within Europe. There are certain traditional structures that require a lot of creativity, thinking outside the box, maybe a bit of, I'm not quite sure how to put it, but you definitely have to go outside the usual path, but with respect for the culture and the traditions. And that's something else I've learned from AGU, because there's the usual joke that the American Geophysical Union is not any of those three words.
Right.
But yet, when you attend, for example, the joint meeting in Japan, you did not feel that AGU was overwhelming the Japan Geophysical Union, Geosciences Union, sorry, that it was a partnership. Mm-hmm. And this is what I very much appreciated in the international reach of AGU, is that it's looking towards the partnership aspects rather than coming in and dominating a local culture. And I think this is really important now for the centennial, because there's many activities that are outside of the usual realm of within the United States. And I've still felt there's a very strong respect for the other partner in these.
So speaking of centennial, one of the things that I like to ask folks when I do these interviews, especially the ones that are directly connected to centennial, is within your science specifically, what would you say is the biggest discovery or accomplishment or paradigm shift in the past 100 years?
Okay, so within my science in particular, which very much relies on technology in order to simulate the conditions inside the Earth, because let's be honest, we can drill 12 kilometers down, which is a tiny fraction of the entire radius, which is 6,071 kilometers. So we need other ways in which to study the material to decide how the atmosphere started and all of these very important questions for us. Before high pressure technology was really there, we weren't able to reach these conditions inside the laboratory. So I think you could just about, the advent of the large volume high pressure apparatus would have caused a discontinuous jump in discoveries. And then the diamond anvil cell is another one. The synchrotron. I wouldn't like to think that technology is pulling the science along. In some respects, sometimes the science gets a little bit ahead of the technology, and that drives technical developments. So the synchrotron in Grenoble, where I spend a large amount of my time, they're upgrading. Very soon they'll shut down, and they're going to be capable of much higher fluxes, much smaller beam sizes. And for example, high pressure science has driven a lot of these developments, because it's not just technicians sitting around saying, well, let's set the world record for the smallest beam size. It's really, well, what is the science that is going to be, what new science will come out of these upgrades? So, I would have to say high pressure technology is
Great. Yeah. And the way that you answered that sort of segued straight into what I normally follow this question up with, which is what problem or scientific question do you hope your science can answer, either for the advancement of science or just the advancement of society in the next 100 years?
Wow. So I've been most of my career in high pressure, but I've realized that my Mussbauer spectrometer, this arcane method that I use, has a really important application to studying chemical reactions on the surface of the Earth. And I found a group that I'm working with involving biologists and chemists, geoecologists, and I actually see the origin of life is within our grasp. And so somewhere in the next 100 years, I probably won't be involved personally, but I've seen the types of communities that have come together, really strong interdisciplinary communities. I mean, I'm learning about omics and the biological side of things, which takes me way back to high school and realizing, wow, it's so good to collaborate with somebody who's an expert because, and it goes two ways because, of course, I provide an expertise that they, so we will study bacteria in the laboratory and see what happens in situ. And so going back to where it all began, I think is something that we could imagine will happen within the next 100 years.
It's great. And I mean, yeah, it seems like such a silly question and so far reaching of a question, but you know, it's something that I know we're trying to think about as we celebrate our 100 years and looking back at all of the advancements that we've made in 100 years. And since we're celebrating that milestone, we really want to, you know, dream big, yeah. And take advantage of this time period to not just reflect on the past, but also look at the future. And that definitely sounds like a bright future to me. I'm going to turn it over to Felicity. Do you have additional questions you want to add before I
close it off? I just wanted to know if you had anything else that you wanted to share, or maybe got inspired by through our conversations that you can use this a great opportunity to bring up or talk about.
So I had an agenda in my head, yeah. Which you've allowed me to express, so I'm really grateful for that, and I feel content with our conversation. And
good, I'm glad that I was able to just really quickly look and look. I'm like, I think I can do this. What, 25 minutes?
Yeah, that's why
yeah. Bringing
him in, right?
Yeah.
I'm just sitting there going, that's fascinating.
Okay, well, no, this was on the airplane I was able to brainstorm this.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to sit down and have these conversations because you want them to be conversations, but at the same time, you know, you definitely have points that you want to get across. So I'm glad that we were able to do that. So we're going to close up then. I'm going to hit the stop button here and